said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Dr. Michael J. Sandel, who teaches political philosophy at Harvard. He's a good friend and a senior fellow of INET, and he is the author of many books and courses. The forthcoming, which is the subject today, is about the tyranny of merit, what's become of the common good, published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux on September 15th. Previously, Dr. Sandel created What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. He's also got a very famous course on justice, and he's been, I would say, not only a great exhibitor of the subjects related to political philosophy, but he's taught my team a lot about the dissemination of interesting education projects around the world. And you can see footage of Dr. Sandel in places like Korea at football stadiums where 14, 15,000 people are there holding up yes and no cards. It's really quite vital. And I know you've also had a tremendous impact in China and in our joint venture with the Lujan Academy now that's founded by the Alibaba Group and Chen Long. Dr. Sandel's work that he's done with INET was one of the real magnets that brought that partnership together. So, Michael, thank you. As always, it's great to be with you and to explore what's on your mind.
It's great to be with you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
So, I just have to ask the question. The tyranny of merit. This is a man teaching at Harvard. What inspired this question? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, it's a fair question, Rob, because I'm writing critically about the meritocracy we have become, even while teaching at a place like Harvard. What really prompted me to write this book was trying to make sense of the upheavals of 2016. Brexit in Britain, the election of Trump in the United States. And there are lots of explanations for the populist backlash against mainstream parties, and especially parties of the center-left. But it seemed to me that one of the important factors in that backlash, generating the resentments that fueled the backlash, was the sense among many working people that elites were looking down on them. And it seems to me that that complaint is legitimate. And so I wanted to understand how it came to be that elites, meritocratic elites, members of the professional classes, the mainstream parties of the center-right and center-left, how is it that we arrived at this moment, this deeply polarized moment filled with anger and rancor and resentment and the politics of grievance? How did this happen? Because unless we can figure out the source of it, I'm not so sure that we'll be able to find a way to beat back the authoritarian populism that has had growing prominence in democracies around the world, and certainly here in the United States.
Well, as I'm hearing you, what comes to my mind is a very simple question. Who gets to be the judge and jury of what merit is? Because if you would say our system, capitalist system, is embedded in a democracy, receives its moral legitimacy from being governed by and accepted by a system that is allegedly representative of everyone, And albeit there's complexities in this society, so it does require some kinds of expertise and trust that these people will look out for the common good. And yet, how would I say, that's gone afoul. People are not feeling like what we call the meritocracy has been chosen by a broad consensus that has inspired respect, trust, and faith. Where is this breaking down?
Well, it's true, Rob. We're not in a good place. Our civic life is not going very well. The divide between winners and losers has been deepening in recent decades, poisoning our politics, driving us apart. I think this has partly to do with the deepening inequality of income and wealth that came about as a result of the market-driven globalization of the last four decades. But it's not only that. It has also to do, I think, with the changing attitudes toward success and failure, toward winning and losing, that have come with it. Those who landed on top during the era of globalization came to believe that their success was their own doing, a measure of their merit. And that those who fell short, those left behind, deserved their fate as well. It's these attitudes toward winning and losing that have generated the sense among many working people, many who struggle, who did not gain from globalization, the sense that elites look down on them. And I think this sense of humiliation, really, demoralization, disempowerment, is what has fueled the populist backlash against elites and against the mainstream political parties who presided over these past four decades of market-driven globalization, rising inequality that heaped enormous rewards on those on top, but left the median wage stagnant in real terms, and more than this, undermined the esteem, the respect, the dignity of work for a great many working people, especially those who didn't have a university degree.
Well, I can see lots of what you might call channels of discouragement, channels of what might be referred to as demoralization. One is many people don't have a degree. It's very expensive to get a degree. The other is those experts you count on to look out for the common good may be looking uphill for prizes, rewards, etc., to serve a very narrow, what I'll call plutocratic elite, and they're not embodying what you might call the concerns of the broad-based society, what I think you refer to in your subtitle as the common good.
Right.
What's the process? I mean, we're hearing a lot now about the role of money in politics.
Right.
We're hearing a lot about what I will call the commodification of social design, meaning it's refracted towards money and away from voters or votes, voter suppression, gerrymandering, the role of money in amplification and campaigning, etc. There just seem to be so many ways in which I would say democracy is frustrated. And then the final piece, but I really want you to suppose, where do the meritocratic types get away with, because they have an advanced degree, looking at the dire outcomes and pretending they're doing a good thing?
Well, it's interesting. The encouraging people to go to college, trying to level the playing field so that everyone has an equal chance, these have been centerpieces of mainstream Democratic Party politics In fact, they've defined the Democrats' political project in recent decades, and not only that of the Democrats, but also of center-right Republicans. Here's how I think it went wrong. In dealing with the deepening inequalities of income and wealth, and also of status and esteem, these mainstream politicians offered the following political project. They said, in a global economy, what you earn will depend on what you learn. They said, everybody should have an equal chance. Everyone should be brought to the same starting point for the race. And we're committed to doing that. We're committed to giving one an equal chance. But that means, given the rigors of global competition, you had better get a college degree if you want to compete and win in the global economy. That was the message. So what this did, in effect, was to respond to the deepening inequality, not directly, but through a promise of individual upward mobility through higher education. That was the offer. And it's summed up in a slogan. I call it the rhetoric of rising. It's summed up in the slogan that everyone should be able to rise as far as their efforts and talents will take them. On the face of it, that's an appealing slogan. Who could disagree with that, the idea that everyone should be able to rise? But there's a dark side to this meritocratic rhetoric of rising. And the dark side is this. If you didn't go to college, and if you're not flourishing in the new economy, your failure must be your fault. This is the dark side. It's the harsh judgment that a meritocratic society passes on those who don't get a four-year university degree. Now, politically, this was a flawed project because most Americans don't have a four-year college degree. Nearly two-thirds don't. And the same is true in Britain and other advanced democracies. And so it was a mistake to create an economy that set as a condition for dignified work and a decent life, a four-year university degree. That was the dark side implicit in the response to inequality that mainstream parties offered. And this goes back to, it goes back to Ronald Reagan, but it gains momentum, the rhetoric of rising that I've described, with Bill Clinton, George W. Bush. It's a bipartisan matter. Barack Obama. He had a slogan, "You can make it if you try," from a pop song. He included that line in his speeches over 100 times as president. Hillary Clinton ran on that rhetoric of rising. But by 2016, it had lost its capacity to inspire, this promise of dealing with inequality through individual upward mobility, because of the insult implicit in that offer for working people who didn't go to a four-year university. It began generating resentments and anger and grievances. And this opened the way for Trump in the U.S. and for other authoritarian populists in other democracies. What the mainstream parties missed, and especially the Democratic Party in the United States, was that by 2016, they had become a party more attuned to technocratic and professional elites than to the blue-collar supporters who once were were a central part of their constituency. And as a result, those those who hadn't been to college, white working men who hadn't been to college, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. they also voted overwhelmingly in Britain for Brexit. And so we see this divide in our politics now, Rob, between those who have and those who haven't received a four-year university degree.
Well, I see this brings many questions to my mind, but the first of which is, it seems like the elites have applied two anesthetics to themselves. The first is what you might call the justification of merit, and if you fall down, it's your own fault. But I think there's also a way in which they're fooling themselves if they feel like while globalization is going on, automation is going on, and everybody's lobbying to keep their tax money at the corporate level and individual level offshore, deferred, paying capital gains someday instead of income today, and then turning to the population and saying, we can't afford it, and then gutting or lobbying very aggressively against public school infrastructure and support. So they're taking the rungs out of the ladder and acting like there's upward mobility is one anesthetic. And the second is they think the meritocracy applies in a way that justifies whatever the outcome is, and they don't have to be concerned about it because it's fair. Where do they get these two notions?
Well, let me first pick up on your image of the rungs on the ladder, because it captures the narrowness of dealing with inequality, thinking that it's possible to deal with inequality through individual upward mobility alone. Mobility is not an adequate answer to the vast inequalities that have occurred in recent decades for a couple of reasons. First, it isn't easy to rise, especially in America. Of those who are born poor, in the bottom 20%, only about 5 to 8% will rise to the top by the time they're adults. And most won't even make it to the middle class. So the idea that in America, we don't have to worry about inequality because, after all, there is mobility one generation to the next. Equality is something that those Europeans have to worry about, those class-based societies, not us. That traditional assurance that America doesn't have to worry so much about inequality, it doesn't fit the facts on the ground. The chance to rise one generation to the next, up the income scale, up the rungs on the ladder, chances are greater of doing that in many European countries than in the U.S. Chances are greater of doing that in Canada than in the U.S. So relying solely on individual upward mobility to solve the problem of inequality doesn't fit the facts on the ground. And in fact, it turns out that those societies that have greater equality, a stronger safety net, universal health care, other kinds of equality, it turns out those societies are more mobile than a society like ours that has deeper inequalities of income and wealth. So that's one problem. But there's a further problem politically. Setting as your political project equipping people for a meritocratic race, to equip them to scramble up the rungs of the ladder of success, has led the Democratic Party and many liberals to neglect the fact that the rungs on the ladder are growing further and further apart. And so I think this is a, and then finally, those who rely on mobility alone as the answer to inequality have not been alive to the insult, the sense of humiliation that this inflicts. When you valorize getting a university degree to such an extent as to make it your primary political program, it's easy to underestimate the demoralizing effect this has on people who don't have university degrees. And in fact, this spreads into social attitudes and the way we recognize and respect people. Surveys have shown, I point this out in the book, Rob, that credentialism is the last acceptable prejudice, both in the U.S. and in Europe. Survey researchers gave people a list of disfavored groups, groups often discriminated against, and they included on the list those with lesser educations. And they found that college-educated respondents rank those with lesser educations as the least liked group of all. And so I think this reflects the valorization of a university degree, not only for economic advancement, but also as a source of social recognition and esteem. And that, I think, has fueled resentments among people who feel the work they do is no longer valued as it once was.
Well, let's turn for a second to what I'll call inside of education. I can imagine being an 18-year-old going to college, seeing how divided with what Peter Temin has called the vanishing middle class. So what you might call benefits of making it can be very high in relation to not.
Right.
So you look at what's in the curriculum. What are the majors? What are the things that you have to learn to succeed in the meritocratic process? Is it business? Is it accounting? Is it technology? Or is it engineering? Because I would think that the people who would be most suited to govern a country would be people who have a broad textured understanding,
yeah,
an awareness of the humanities, of history,
right,
of political science, of all kinds of aspects of social problems, which includes financial instability and environmental challenges and so forth. But are we not only declaring something a meritocracy in a way that's alienating, are we creating a meritocracy that isn't capable of being sensitive to the creation of the common good?
Well, it's a very important question, Rob, and it really, what it forces us to reflect on is what qualities, what abilities make for good governing, for effective leadership in a democracy, and for that matter, for good citizenship. There's the tendency to think that expertise, expert knowledge, is the only or the primary qualification for governing well. And many of our universities put great emphasis on the acquisition of technocratic expertise and knowledge. Now, it is certainly true, and we see this during the pandemic, we need leaders who either have or can rely upon expert scientific and medical and public health advice and knowledge. That's very important. But what it really takes, what the the knowledge required to govern well is by no means limited to technocratic knowledge. And it's certainly not limited to the kind of knowledge that is increasingly taught in our universities under the heading of economics. And this is something, Rob, you've thought a lot about. The reason is that to govern well requires practical judgment, what Aristotle called practical wisdom. And this includes civic virtue. It isn't only technical expertise, it's a matter of judgment, informed by history, but also informed by a familiarity with one's fellow citizens from all walks of life and concern about them. So when the virtues required to govern well include knowledge, not only of technical subjects, but also of, well, ultimately, the good life, the common good, the ability to reason together with one's fellow citizens about the nature of a just society, the meaning of the good life, what we owe one another as citizens. Civic life understood in this way is a project of civic education, not just a project of technocratic expertise. And yet, the kind of knowledge that prospective political leaders acquire in our universities today has more to do with technocratic expertise of a fairly narrow kind than with the broad humane learning. And you mentioned the liberal arts, the classics, history, philosophy, civic education, but also the ability, and this is a human quality not taught in universities, the ability to identify with people from many different backgrounds and walks of life. And so it's not only a problem of what we're teaching in the universities. The problem is also that our representative institutions during this age of merit have increasingly become places where almost no, or at least very, very few people without a university degree are found in the halls of Congress or in the parliaments of Britain or Europe or in the executive branches of government. In fact, the percentage of people without a college degree in representative government is as low today as it was back in the 19th century when there were property qualifications for voting. Now, during the mid-20th century, when we abolished those property qualifications, it was very common for people who hadn't been to university, who came from working class backgrounds, to serve in government, to be elected to Congress. Today, 95% of the members of Congress and the Senate have university degrees, and only a tiny fraction come from working class backgrounds. And it's the same is true in Britain and in democracies of Europe. So this is the second way in which the age of merit essentially has excluded working people from representative government. And that's even before we get, Rob, to the problems you were mentioning earlier about the role of money in political campaigns, which is yet another form of disenfranchisement of working people. So for all of these reasons, the credentialed few are governing the uncredentialed many, the majority of citizens. And this isn't good for democracy.
No. Well, this kind of technocratic education, I'm always reminded of the great psychologist C.G. Jung, who said, beware of too much luster and beauty because the shadow lurks nearby. And it's kind of Shakespearean or poetic for people to sense the yin and yang, the contradictions, and and the darkness that accompanies this kind of technocratic glistening.
Could I just interject, please, please. Rob? That brings to mind an example, famous example from, and it's from the 1960s, mm-hmm. in the famous book by David Halberstam, "The Best and the Brightest," which he this wonderful phrase that he made the title of his book. It was an ironic phrase, "The Best and the Brightest." He tells the story of Lyndon Johnson bedazzled when he became vice president, of John F. Kennedy's cabinet and advisors, all of these people with lustrous credentials from Ivy League universities and from the top American corporations, and the whiz kids, they called them, from Ford, people like McNamara and the like. And LBJ was telling Sam Rayburn, his mentor, then Speaker of the House, about how brilliant were all of these people Kennedy had assembled. And Rayburn said to LBJ, "They may all be as smart as you say, Lyndon, but I wish just a few of them had run for sheriff once." And of course, the best and the brightest, as Halberstam tells the story, these were the, for all their technocratic brilliance, they led us into the folly of the Vietnam War. And then by the age of merit that I'm focusing on in the book, which is the last four decades, the meritocratic elite didn't govern so well. They deregulated the financial industry. They brought us the financial crisis of 2008. They brought us a bank bailout after the crisis that didn't hold those responsible to account, that didn't do much to help ordinary homeowners, that generated a deep political resentment on the right and the left. The governing elite of the last four decades also brought us very skewed economic growth that didn't benefit the bottom half of the population. They brought us the war in Iraq. They brought us a 19-year war in Afghanistan of various dubious consequences. They brought us declining infrastructure. They brought us, as we've discussed already, a system of campaign finance in which money talks louder than citizens. So it's rather difficult to say that even from the standpoint of successful governing, that the meritocratic elite of the last four decades has covered itself with glory.
Yeah, it reminds me of Bob Dylan's lyric, "Money doesn't talk, it swears." But, it's very interesting to me because inside of this meritocratic energy is a kind of naivety or innocence. I often think of the great historian E.H. Carr. He wrote a book, What is History? And this was at a time when everybody wanted to be, quote, evidence-based. And he had a famous quote. I can't remember who he quoted, but he said, "Facts are like sacks. If you don't put something in them, they don't stand up." Yeah. And the interpretive gifts, the interpretive skills, the judgment. There's a modern poet who goes by the name In Q, short for In Question. And he has a famous saying. Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist at NYU, has, I believe, cited it several times. "You will always find the evidence for what you choose to believe." And so the idea that teaching this technocracy and that the evidence would appear, you would have the skills to diagnose it, has some truth in it. But it's also embedded in what you might call the emotional context of power. and identity right. and affirmation. And what you choose to find often has a lot to do with your priors, which is that emotional context.
Right. And this role of fact, it looms large in a certain account of what's gone wrong with our politics and what accounts for the depolarization. The explanation, the familiar, the conventional explanation focuses on facts, just in the way that you've suggested, Rob. The idea is this. The reason we can't agree on just about anything, the reason our politics is so polarized, is that we can't agree on the facts. And we hear this all the time. And the reason we can't agree on climate change, for example, is that those who are opposed to action on climate change don't believe in science. And the reason they don't believe in science, the reason we can't agree on the facts, as we all listen to different social media sites and different cable news networks and so on. Now, there is something to this. We are riven by the sources of information on which we rely. It's a source of separation. But here's the mistake in thinking about polarization as mainly a problem about different facts. The problem is this. The reason, and this is in line with what you were suggesting, Rob, it's not so much the case that we disagree about politics because we don't share certain common facts. It's that we can't agree on the facts because we are deeply divided politically. Take the example of climate change. If the climate change deniers, if the problem were simply that they didn't have the right facts, then you would expect that the partisan disagreement about what to do about climate change would be reduced among people with more education and with more scientific knowledge. But in fact, as I point out in the book, it's just the opposite. There is a partisan divide on whether climate change is man-made and what should be done about it. There is a partisan divide across all levels of education. But that divide is the smallest among those with lesser educational degrees. And those who have university degrees and those who have scientific knowledge and have taken scientific courses, among them, the partisan divide is greater, not lesser. And this is because Republicans with high levels of education adhere even more passionately to their party's renunciation of measures to deal with climate change than those with less education. What this suggests is that it's not the lack of agreement on basic facts that is driving our polarization. It's that the polarization, political polarization, is creating this gulf of shared orientation to facts. And so this, I think, so simply saying, you know, we need to bring science to bear in these debates. Well, that's true in a way, but the reason people hold fast to their positions on climate change, or for that matter on mask wearing and the vaccine and these quack cures like hydrochloroquine and so on, the way to deal with those divisions is not to insist on science. Science is not going to solve that. What these divisions reflect, and you see this with mask wearing, is a lack of trust. A lack of trust in the people, in the parties, in the authorities who are telling us to wear masks. For those who reject mask wearing, it's about trust, which is a political matter. It's not about science, really. And the same is true among those who reject measures to deal with climate change. And so I think we need to recognize that this has been a failure of political argument and political persuasion that is connected to the resentment against meritocratic elites that recent decades and the attitudes toward success we've been discussing give rise to.
I remember talking with some of my friends. I grew up in Detroit, and Donald Trump had spoken right after the Republican convention as a candidate to the Economic Club of Detroit. And all of these guys are MBAs, MDs, CPA, professional advanced degrees. And they said to me, they actually were inspired by Trump because he came in and he scolded management. He didn't pander to management. And we had this dinner and we talked about it. And we said, well, if you, every 4 years, if you could take a political campaign, the equivalent of the bumper sticker and send it up to Mars for posterity, what would be the one that Trump would author? And one of my friends said, the system is rigged. And I heard Trump say that exact phrase over and over and over again in Michigan and in other places.
It's interesting. It's the same message that Bernie Sanders had, that the system is rigged. Mm-hmm. And in her way that Elizabeth Warren had. And so on the left and on the right with Trump, there is this blunt recognition that the system is rigged, which is a different political argument than the idea you can make it if you try. You too can, if you get a university degree, enjoy upward mobility and not be burdened by the inequality that afflicts so many Americans. We should, since we're in the run-up to the election, I think it's important to notice the implications of our conversation or with this diagnosis for the current campaign. And I have a worry. My worry is that the Democrats and those in the media who are appalled by Trump, rightly so, are asking the wrong question. When I turn on cable news or the evening news or read the newspaper, almost every day there is a new cascade of lies from Trump, and at least every other day, a new outrageous statement, whether it was the revelation by Bob Woodward that Trump said he deliberately downplayed the seriousness of the pandemic, whether it was a few days before the revelation that Trump had called fallen American soldiers suckers and losers. Each day there is a new outrage. And each news cycle, we discuss among ourselves whether this will be the final outrage to sink Trump with the voters, those who support him. And with each new outrage, we think maybe this will be the one. But, and it goes all the way back to that Access Hollywood tape when we thought, well, this will surely sink him, back before the election in 2016. I think by now we should get the hang of it and realize that we are asking the wrong question. The question is not which new outrage will finally sink Trump and cause at least some of his supporters to reject him. The real question we should be asking is, why is it that with all of these outrages, which demonstrate again and again how unfit he is for office, why is it that nonetheless, 46 or 47 or 48 or 49% of the electorate are for him, and somewhat more in key states. Why is that? And part of the answer has to do with the way he appeals to racism and misogyny and xenophobia, all of those dark things. But if that's the only answer we hit upon, we're missing something. What we're missing is that entangled with those ugly sentiments are some legitimate grievances. And those legitimate grievances have something to do with the failed governing project of the mainstream Democrats and the mainstream Republicans who were in power in the decades leading up to 2016. And those failures contributed, and those failures have to do with the embrace of a market-driven version of globalization, an acceptance or a failure to deal with the inequalities that resulted. Those failures have given rise to resentments among working people, even a sense of humiliation, that they've not only been left behind economically in terms of jobs and wages, but also in terms of social recognition, respect, and esteem. That's the heart of it. And what makes that a hard recognition for Democrats and for mainstream political figures, for the governing class, is that those angers and resentments resulted from the way they governed. It resulted from the kind of technocratic, market-driven version of globalization over which they presided. And unless there is a moment of self-critical recognition of the failed mode of governing that paved the way to Trump, I'm afraid we're asking the wrong question, and Joe Biden's campaign may not even succeed. And if it doesn't succeed, see, there is a theory that says if, you know, the Trump has so botched the pandemic and has so undermined constitutional norms and has so inflamed racial tensions that surely the country will take a decent man as an alternative. I'm afraid that that won't be enough. Biden could win those arguments and still lose the election unless he and the Democratic Party face up to the failure of the mainstream political project of recent decades and question not only the inequality, but also the diminished status of working people in the society, and the meritocratic hubris of elites that has gone with it. That's my worry. And I'd be interested to know, Rob, if you've seen any hint or evidence that the Democratic Party is prepared to look at itself in the mirror and reflect on how its policies contributed to creating the resentments that gave rise to Trump.
I share your concerns precisely, because what I see is not just a good citizen as an alternative to Trump who keeps doing negative things. I see a society which views the candidate, Joe Biden, as a co-architect of the 8 years that produced Donald Trump.
Right.
And I'm not putting things on Joe's fingerprints.
Right.
At all. I'm saying he's associated with a context, and that Donald Trump didn't descend from Mars. He came organically from the dysfunction you've been describing over the last 50 minutes. And so we're in a place where comforting yourself with how bad Trump is not the same as going into yourself
right.
and telling the American people that you feel how they've suffered, that you've been complicit in mistakes, and we need a market-changing course here and now.
I agree.
I don't know, to be fair a little bit, that it's so much about personality as it is about the systemic dysfunction, whereas I call it the commodification of social design, enforcement, implementation, has created a constellation of political leaders whose survival has depended upon their subservience to this broken system.
Right, right.
And without recognizing that, without stepping up to that, they will not regain the faith or the trust in expertise, in leadership, in caring.
Right.
They have to go to confession analogously. And they have to face their failings in order to rebuild that trust.
We should.
I mean, I'm not talking about rebuild it completely. I'm talking to get to the starting gate on the pathway.
Right.
And so I want to use our remaining time, Michael. Let's just say hypothetically that I was the nominee and I won the election and you're my primary advisor. So there's something about the campaign we've been talking about, but I'm actually talking about how do we govern for the next 4 years so that the next Trump doesn't win in a landslide in 4 years.
Right.
What do we have to do vis-a-vis the dignity of work, vis-a-vis the unmasking of the pandemic, about all of the failures that this self-satisfied meritocratic elite didn't see
right.
coming? What do we have to do as an alternative to market technocracy and cold-hearted, unjust meritocracy?
Right.
What do we got to build to start
great
that
question.
Process?
Great question. And I think you framed it in just the right way, Rob, because even if Biden does win, he will still have to address the questions you've just asked if he's going to succeed in his presidency rather than simply fuel a persisting backlash. So here's how I would try to answer, Rob. And the book, last couple of chapters, try to take this up. First, I would put the dignity of work at the center of politics. I would focus less on the rhetoric of rising. I would focus less on equipping the people to arm themselves for meritocratic competition and focus more on making life better for people who make important contributions to the economy and to the society through the work they do, the families they raise, the communities they serve, who make these contributions whether or not they are well-credentialed, but many of whom don't really enjoy the social recognition and esteem they deserve for a number of reasons. We've discussed the inequality, the wage stagnation, the outsourcing of jobs, the gutting of manufacturing areas brought about through the version of neoliberal globalization that has been promoted in recent decades. But there are other elements, too, that have demoralized work, devalued work in the traditional sense. One of them, which we haven't discussed yet, Rob, is the financialization of the economy that has been taking place during these same years, where a greater and greater proportion of GDP and of corporate profits are accounted for by financial activity, which is highly remunerated and which seems pretty distant, much of it, from any actual tangible contribution to the real economy. And so it's been estimated. Of course, the function of finance is very important, the basic social function of finance, which is to direct capital to socially important productive activities, new factories, companies, homes, schools, roads, hospitals. But a relatively small percentage of financial activity today consists of investing in the real economy. Much of it has to do with speculative financial instruments or with activities such as high-frequency trading that arguably don't contribute much to the real economy. Adair Turner, another INET friend and affiliate, has estimated that only 15% of financial activity in the highly developed financial systems of the UK and the US actually go into investing in new companies or actual tangible investments, and that 85% consists of speculation on already existing real estate or derivatives and so on. Now, this, I think, has contributed, this growing gap between what people recognize as a valuable contribution to the common good and what we reward, this gap has grown ever greater. And I think it's contributed to the demoralization of work in the traditional sense. When people who spend their days producing valuable goods and services for other people, and when they find that their economic rewards and their social esteem pales by comparison with the rewards and the esteem enjoyed by those who engage, let's say, in highly speculative financial activity, manipulation, and so on, this is deeply demoralizing to the dignity of work. So political agenda defined by the dignity of work is really a political agenda that says we can't assume that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good. We need to deliberate as democratic citizens about what social roles really do contribute in important ways to the common good and find ways of rewarding them. So it's hard to have this debate purely in the abstract. So I suggest in the book some policies that might prompt debates of this broader kind. Should we have wage subsidies for essential kinds of work that the labor market doesn't adequately reward, for example? Should we swap the payroll tax, which is a tax on labor, for a financial transactions tax, not only on redistributive or fairness grounds, but also as a way of prompting a debate about whether, say, the speculative domains of finance really do contribute in proportion to the rewards that they now attract, by comparison with the work of ordinary labor. So these are just examples. Another would be, should we really tax earnings from labor at a higher rate than we tax earnings from interest and dividends? Should the tax system give preference to interest over equity. This is a question that Rana Faruhar raises in her book, Makers and Takers. So I think a political program focusing on the dignity of work could be quite far-reaching if it were understood not just as a hortatory rhetorical exercise in praising working people and saying they're the backbone of the country, but tangible measures, and we haven't even discussed strengthening unions and the voice of working people in politics and in the companies for which they work. But what I think we need, what the Democratic Party needs, what Biden needs, even if he wins, is a broad political agenda, beginning with the dignity of work, that raises fundamental questions about the structure of the economy, and that raises what is ultimately a normative question. And this really is the point of my book, The Tyranny of Merit. What's become of the common good? We need to find a language of, in order to debate what counts as a contribution, we need a language of the common good. We need to reason together as democratic citizens about what purposes and ends are worthy of us as a country. We need to argue about, to deliberate about, the meaning of the common good, because our public discourse has been empty, Rob, during this period of technocratic, meritocratic globalization. It's as if we've outsourced our moral judgments to markets. What I'm suggesting in the book is that we need to reclaim them as democratic citizens to reason together about the common good as the basis for reconfiguring our economy in a way that brings dignity and respect and social esteem to those who contribute greatly to the common good, but in the current economy often go unrecognized.
Well, in your presentation, in the conclusion of your book, there were two authors I recalled, R.H. Tawney, who wrote a book called Equality in 1931, and the person who coined the notion of the American Dream, James Truslow Adams, whose book was called The Epic of America. I guess I would throw into this salad Michael Young's book on the rise of meritocracy. If they were sitting at the table with you right now, what ingredients would they add to the recipe that you're prescribing?
Well, earlier in the book is where I discuss Michael Young, who after all coined the term meritocracy in the late 1950s. And what's interesting, looking back on Michael Young's original use of the term, is that he did not present this as an ideal or as the definition of a just society. For him, meritocracy described a condition in which people were not assigned their fates by the hereditary aristocracy of a class-based society, and that was certainly a step forward. That was a good thing. But he saw the dark side of a society that defined status and place on the basis of talent. What he recognized was that the closer a society came to being a perfect meritocracy, the greater would be the tendency for those on top to believe that their success was their own doing. And the greater would be the tendency to look down on those who hadn't succeeded as lacking the talents and the drive to make their way to the top. So he anticipated what I call the meritocratic hubris of elites and the sense of demoralization, even the humiliation those who fall behind, who struggle in a society defined by merit. As for the figures I write about at the end of the book, one of them is R.H. Tawney, a British economic historian and social critic, who argued that equality of opportunity is at best a partial ideal. Of course, we should remove barriers to achievement, barriers of race and class and gender, and everyone should be able to compete for jobs based on their qualifications for those jobs and for social positions generally. But Tawney saw, and I think he was right, that equality of opportunity, however important, is a remedial ideal. It doesn't by itself define a just society. For a just society, one needs a broad democratic equality of condition, which doesn't mean equality of result. It doesn't mean everyone has to have the same amount of money. But what it does mean is that everyone has to enjoy social recognition, esteem, and respect. Everyone has to have access to the learning that enables people to be effective democratic citizens, to share in the broad public culture and in the common life. And finally, as you mentioned, Rob, I discuss at the end of the book the writer who coined the term the American dream. And I point out that we often assume the American dream is synonymous with what I've called the rhetoric of rising. Everyone should be able to rise as far as their talents and efforts will take them. But James Truslow Adams, who coined this term, actually had a more demanding notion of the American dream than upward mobility alone. He, too, had in mind what could be described as a broad democratic equality of condition, with shared learning and deliberation about the common good. He gives an example that I found moving of the Library of Congress, the reading room. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to read the way he describes what struck him about this. As one looks down on the general reading room, which contains thousands of volumes which may be read without even asking, one sees the seats filled with silent readers, old and young, rich and poor, black and white, the executive and the laborer, the general and the private, the noted scholar and the schoolboy, all reading at their own library, provided by their own democracy. And I remember this is in the early 1930s. This was in the midst of the Depression. Adams saw this scene as an example, a concrete example of what he meant by the American dream. It wasn't only about individual upward mobility. It was about a certain kind of shared common life. And then I, for my part, conclude, Rob, that we don't really have that shared common life today. And I've tried to explain why. And explaining how we emerge from it, we've talked about a political agenda based on the dignity of work. I would just mention, as we conclude, one more thing that would be required. Beyond policies that could enact a greater dignity of work across the society, I think we need a change in attitudes. We need to question our meritocratic hubris. Because if we really believe that our success is our due, it's very difficult to picture ourselves in other people's shoes. On the other hand, a greater appreciation of the role of luck in life can prompt a certain humility. It can prompt our looking at those less fortunate than ourselves and saying, there, but for the accident of fate, or the luck of the draw, or the grace of God, go I. This is how meritocracy pulls us away from solidarity, away from an appreciation of the common good, but a recognition of the elements of luck in our success, in the family and community and country and circumstances that enable us to flourish. All of that is not my own doing, one's own doing. It can enable us to recapture, I think, a sense of indebtedness to the communities that enable us to flourish. And it can induce a kind of humility that I think is the beginning of the way back from the harsh ethic of success that drives us apart. Humility, Rob, I think is the civic virtue we most need at this moment. It can point us beyond the tyranny of merit toward a less rancorous, more generous public life.
Well, Michael, I've enjoyed greatly where you've taken us today. And I am always what you might call inspired by musical lyrics to help me, what you might call sense, where my spirit is being guided. And as you were speaking today, through most of it, I kept hearing from the third verse of Marvin Gaye's song, What's Going On, where he says that you've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. But in the conclusion, where you started to talk about that humility and the common good and the caring with such passion, I actually go back to the first verse and the second verse where he's appealing first to his mother and father, where he says, you know, we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. You are a person who combines mind and heart with great vitality, and we are all very fortunate that you sit as you do, as strong as you are, as gifted as you are, and as purposeful as you are at Harvard University, where what you might call some of those on the pathway to the inside have a chance, along with the rest of us, in the dissemination through TED Talks and journalism and books. We all have a chance to learn from you about how to change course. And I think this book, not unlike your previous books, is a lightning rod. It's illuminating and it's inspiring. Thank you for being with me today. I look forward to the next time we talk.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you so much. Thanks, Rob.
Michael Sandel's book, The Tyranny of Merit, will be released on Tuesday, September 15th. I almost feel like we've got to go out and find somebody like Jeff Bezos to give a copy to every man, woman, and child in our country so we can start setting our course in the right direction. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rob.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. and I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.